Please be seated. So let me make sure that you've got the picture as Jesus painted it. Two men went up to the temple to pray. One was a Pharisee who prayed, "God, I thank you that I'm pure and righteous, not like common criminals, not like that tax collector I see over there praying." And at the same time, the tax collector was praying, "Lord, have mercy on me, a sinner." Jesus said, "It's not the strictly devout one that received forgiveness and reconciliation with God. It was the tax collector." Now, it's important to set this up for you just a little bit more because I want you to consider as you listen to this sermon, which of these two who are praying you might be. That can sometimes be a worthwhile pursuit to ask, who am I in this story? So I'm not going to give you an exhaustive description of either, not of the Pharisee, but let me tell you a few things. First, according to some scholars, Pharisee means those who are set apart or those who set themselves apart. So this Pharisee would have gone to great lengths to set himself apart to maintain his purity. Pharisees often made a great show of loving God. They went through some ridiculously difficult and absurd practices to make sure that their faith was being displayed publicly. Some were called the bruised Pharisees. These men believed that to even look at a woman on the street in public, even if it was a sister, a wife, a cousin, a mother, to look at a woman in public was a sin. So they walked about with cloths covering their faces, not a little veil, but cloth covering their faces to help prevent them from the evil of seeing a woman in public. And as a result, they would run into things. And they would show up at the synagogue with bumps and bruises everywhere to highlight their purity. Another bunch of Pharisees would not lift their heads from the roads as they walked in a dramatic show of their humility. They wouldn't even lift their feet out of the dust on the ground. They would shuffle along, bent over, and they were proud of developing hunchbacks and being covered with dirt as symbols of their self-effacing nature. So there's that. And then the tax collector is another story. Tax collectors are looked down upon the rest of the Jews because they are pawns and employees of the Roman government. We often try to make this first century tax collector into our own version of a 21st century tax collector. We imagine this person working in some position that would bring scorn from the general population, like maybe this tax collector is a 2021 IRS auditor, someone you never want to do business with, someone who doesn't care how careful you are when you are filing your taxes or what percentage of your hard-earned wages go to the government. So, yeah, okay, maybe we can see ourselves in this tax collector much easier than we can see ourselves in the self-righteous Pharisee, because we think of ourselves not so much as really bad sorts, just regular people who mess up every once in a while, take stock of ourselves every once in a while, ask God for forgiveness every once in a while. But by applying our 21st sensibilities to this tax collector, we miss the mark. First of all, it's not accurate to equate the tax collector with a modern-day IRS agent. Tax collectors are seen in a much more positive light by us in this modern day than they would have been by Jesus' first century hearers. We must understand that the tax collector wasn't just unpopular, he was hated by the people, and with reason. He was a willing collaborator in the oppression perpetrated by the Roman Empire. The tax collector, you see, had sort of a franchise agreement. The tax collector had to collect and turn over a certain amount to the Romans. But anything they collected above that, they got to keep. David Jacobson warns us that tax collectors are not merely misunderstood. They are on the wrong side. Religiously, politically, economically. So we might do better to think of this tax collector as some sort of maybe modern-day slumlord, charging exorbitant prices for rundown properties, refusing to address maintenance or even safety concerns, and ready to evict at a moment's notice. Or if you can't work up sufficient moral outrage for that kind of landlord, how about a drug dealer? How about that really despicable drug dealer who gets kids hooked by offering them free drugs till they're addicted? Can you work up some disgust for that person? And are you still okay with maybe being that person in the story? Well, you should be, because the tax collector and only the tax collector left the temple justified. That's what Jesus said, justified, meaning just what it means when you justify a margin. If you're my age or older or close to it, perhaps you took typing in school and you learned that to justify a margin was hard as heck without a computer, and it meant to line it up. Make it right. Jesus said, "This is the one who was made right, who was made righteous." God justified this tax collector, made it as if the tax collector had never done anything wrong. All wiped away, all forgiven, period. And that's why we don't really mind being the tax collector. We mess up, and we're made right by humbling ourselves before God and asking for forgiveness. But let's step outside the story for just a moment. Let's consider this tax collector who is justified from a different perspective. Let's take the long view. In fact, I bet you often do consider the long view, even if it's only subconsciously. What do you think happened when the tax collector went home? We don't know. We'll never know. But many of us think we know, right? We think the tax collector went home and straightened out his act, recognized the error of his ways, felt his heart grow three sizes bigger, maybe stopped on the way home and bought a turkey for a little kid named Tim. That's what we think, isn't it? But we don't know. What if that tax collector went home, did his despicable job for another week, and then came back to the temple 7 days later and prayed, "Lord, have mercy on me, a sinner"? Would he go home justified? Yes. That's what the parable tells us. And what about the next week? Same story. No change. And the next, according to this parable, he goes home justified. The tax collector, we are clearly told, leaves justified because of his acknowledgement of his sin and his prayer for mercy, period. But how that nags at some of us. We know our Bibles, faith without works is dead. Go and sin no more. We know our theologians like Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who assure us only the one who believes is obedient, and only the one who is obedient believes. And here's where I get jerked up by this parable. I go into it willing to believe that the sinner, the tax collector, the bad guy, is forgiven rather than the self-righteous Pharisee, the observant Pharisee. I am even willing to imagine myself as the tax collector. But if I sit with it for a while, if I let it swim around in my conscience for a while, if I start considering the changes in the tax collector's actions that I am certain should accompany his being justified, none of which, remember, is mentioned or implied in this parable. When I start deciding how this should play out, I become the Pharisee. I become the Pharisee, one of the self-righteous religious who can't leave forgiveness and salvation up to God because God might just go entirely too easy on some people. I'd become one of the self-righteous religious who will tell you that grace and forgiveness are absolutely free, but then admit that while they appear free, they are actually being subsidized somehow. I become one of the self-righteous religious whom a third of young people see as intolerant, hypocritical, and judgmental, and because of whom a third won't even give a church a try. Here's what I want you to remember. Jesus didn't just use parables to teach little object lessons. He used proverbs for that. Jesus told parables when he wanted to set us on our ear. By grace, the parable teaches us, we are saved through faith, and that not of ourselves, never of ourselves, not possible of ourselves. 99 times out of 100, you will hear and I will preach, if you love God, you will do what is right. Or once you love God, you will want to do what is right. Or love God and try to do less wrong. 99 times out of 100. We hear that, we preach it because it complements our Sound of Music theology. We catch ourselves humming it every now and then, don't we? The words running through our minds with Maria's perfect pitch and pronunciation. Perhaps I had a wicked childhood. Perhaps I had a miserable youth, but somewhere in my wicked, miserable past, there must have been a moment of truth. For here you are standing there loving me, whether or not you should. So somewhere in my youth or childhood, I must have done something good. It's everywhere. This idea that we earn God's grace, we are purveyors of it, we are perpetuators of it. We want to blame the Pharisee in the story for being self-righteous, for telling God how good he is, for thinking he can follow the rules and exhibit virtue and earn God's blessing, can somehow make himself worthy of God's favor and grace. But then we turn around and expect the tax collector to shape up and make himself or ourselves worthy after we're justified. Okay, God, I'll accept this grace, but just this once. We are not going to let you keep giving us free grace. We're not good at accepting this free grace. We're not good at teaching it. We're not good at preaching it. Well, today I'm going to lock away my self-righteous, Pharisaic self. I called this sermon, "You Should See the Other Guy." I've had a few run-ins with things lately. And when you're walking around bruised or with something broken, people often ask you, what's the other guy look like? Sometimes we say it ourselves, you should see the other guy. And we're half joking, half trying to save face. Sometimes it's a diversionary tactic. Sometimes it's part of something cruel like this. Pharisee, look at the other guy. Today, you can take it at face value. You should see the other guy. Really? Look at him. No, don't look at what's wrong with him. Don't look at the way he's failed, but really look at him. See where she's struggling. See where she's tired. Where he's worn down to the last nerve and where all the cracks and bruises are on her heart. And offer them grace. And then do the same for yourself. Even though it's really hard for me, I'm going to offer this to you. Today, I want you to believe it's as easy as St. Augustine says it is. Love God with all your heart and then do whatever you please. It scares me to say that. I know the verses. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter heaven, but only the one who does the will of God who is in heaven. And I know what Paul says, I know what pastors say, and Sunday school teachers, and the devout, and what this parable says. The one who simply prayed, Lord, have mercy on me, a sinner, went home justified. Oh, but that offends our Christian sensibilities. Or if we're being completely honest, it offends our Pharisaic sensibilities. You might even think your pastor is being irresponsible. But I'm okay today with your being mad at me because I'm being too free with God's love and too generous with God's grace. We know each other pretty well by now. You know that I believe it's more than one sermon or one paragraph or certainly one sentence in one sermon. I'm going to trust God enough, though. Not trust you enough, but trust God enough to offer you these words and only these and leave it at that. Pray this way. Lord, have mercy on me, a sinner. Amen.